Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
He's funny before I even start. Wish you had a better job? Raise his hand. Don't even have a job? Raise your hand. My guess is Will Durst, the legendary. I mean, that word is tossed around these days. They say somebody's got two hits, he's become legendary. But this guy's really legendary.
Well, see, I don't have any hits, so you have to be hugely legendary.
BS, that's your typical Christian modesty. Give me a break. Comedian Will Durst, he's done a ton. He's performed at events featuring Bill Clinton, George H.W. Bush, and Al Gore. He's also keynoted a mayor's and a governor's conference. He writes regularly for HuffPo. He's a former contributing editor to National Lampoon, formerly the Harvard Lampoon. Harvard? Are you a Harvard graduate?
No.
I didn't think so. But he's written for the New York Times, the Funny Times, which if you haven't heard of it, it is the Harvard of funny publications. They got the real premier guys.
It's a humor compendium.
A compendium of the superstar stuff. And most impressive of all, he's written for the San Francisco Chronicle. His weekly podcast, heard on various radio stations, and his website, Will Durst, Durst spelled funny, durst.com. This is amazing to me. 5 times he's been an Emmy nominee, and he won being the host and co-producer of PBS, our big brother, Livelihood. He's also a regular commentator on all the Alphabet Soup, NPR, CNN, C-SPAN. He's been on TV over 800.
Yeah, I think that's lowballing it, actually.
You're
yeah.
old.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So you see, we're going to be doing age reverse age discrimination. We're having you on only because you're old. If you're young, forget it.
Screw the kids.
Perfect. Exactly. There's going to be the feds are going to be on you by the time the show's over. They'll be in here. They'll carry you out with
for age discrimination.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. You'll never work again. He's received 7 consecutive nominations. No cherry picking here for the American Comedy Stand-Up Award Comedian of the Year. His show on the presidential election, Elect to Laugh, ran and is running. It ran for 41 weeks at the San Francisco Marsh Theater. He's doing it a billion times between now and the 65 days until November, whatever the election day is. And he's also doing a show, because he's really lazy, only does only 2 shows at a time, called Boomer Raging from LSD to OMG, oh my God, which he's performed in 30 cities. He's written 3 books, including Elect to Laugh and The All-American Sport of Bipartisan Bashing. He's also released 5 audio recordings, but this is the most impressive. And those of you that regularly listen to the show know, I usually do 2-line introductions, but this guy's is amazing. Durst was used as a phone-a-friend lifeline on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. The question, which was worth $500,000, and the contestant had the brilliant insight to call Durst and used his answer
as a phone-a-friend.
Yes,
and the question was, who directed Michael Jackson's Bad video?
And your answer was?
My answer was, I can't remember.
Doesn't matter.
John,
the result.
Was his name. But it was actually, I was wrong.
That's the point. Give me the punchline.
It was Scorsese.
Right.
So the guy ended up with $32,000 instead of, he lost $218,000.
That's it. Will Durst lost this guy.
Rudy Reber. I'm going to see him not 2 weeks from today on Comedy Celebration Day in the park, which is September 18th, and he always comes back for it. So he doesn't hate me too much.
That's remarkable. Somebody cost me $218,000. I'm not sure I'd be
hanging
with him on the green.
Yeah.
Anyway, with me to hopefully offer better advice than that. Or at least
John Landis is what I said. John Landis.
I don't even know who that is.
He's the guy who directed Twilight Zone and Kentucky Fried Movie and Blues Brothers and a bunch of stuff.
Anyway, you were dead wrong.
I was.
Anyway, hopefully some serious truths about what it's really like to be a comedian. Will Durst.
Thank you, man. Welcome. Thank you, Marty Nemko. Dr. Nemko.
Yeah. Let's start chronologically. Do you remember a first moment you decided to try being a comedian?
I always thought it was so cool being a comedian, because I got to watch The Tonight Show, because in the Midwest, they ran it an hour earlier. So it was 10:30 at night, which wasn't too late. I could sneak my way up to that. And I loved the comics, and I loved the reaction they got. And also, comedy was a currency in our family, because I have a brother who's developmentally disabled. Mm. And Marky can't speak, but he can hang with you. But you can't talk about politics or stuff because he's nonverbal. But he does have a sense of humor. You could make him laugh by doing slapstick, you know, pretending to drink out of your cheek, you know, throwing the cup up there and then watching it dribble down, and he would laugh. So making Marky laugh was a big deal in our family around the dinner table and just in general. So those two things kind of dovetailed. There was no real course curriculum to follow, right, you know, to become a stand-up comedian. Not in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Well, you think in the public school in San Francisco, you know, they're busy teaching quadratic equations and the causes of the Peloponnesian Wars. There's not a lot of room for comedy.
No, but you got SOTA over there. You got the School of the Arts.
Okay.
You know, and the same thing in New York. You had the School for the Arts. So in Milwaukee, we didn't have that. And there wasn't a lot of nightlife, so it was a hard thing. So what I did was I went to college, and even before college, in high school, I studied this stuff. And I studied journalism and theater and film and broadcasting, because they were all tangential to stand-up comedy, you know, in terms of promoting yourself and learning how to write your material and getting on stage. So by that time, and I did plays, and, you know, I did radio, and I wrote humor columns for the local underground newspaper. Mm. So by the time I got on stage, and there was a couple of ways that I did it, but I had kind of triangulated, you know, being a stand-up comic, you know, and it wasn't a big leap to get on that stage. It wasn't a huge, you know, it's just a boom. And the first open mic I did in Milwaukee, it was a Monday night. They were charging $1 at the door. And it was at a place called the Rusty Nail, which was on Juno, right across from the Harp, for all those 414s out there. And it was every Monday night. And the first night I went there, there was like 11 comics on stage. Mm. And I was like the fourth best. Already, my first time, because the other ones had no idea what they were doing. You know, they were confused by the stage thing, or they hadn't memorized their words or something. So, yeah, so I felt, well, wow, I can do this.
Well, when there's a lot of comics there, then why'd you leave Milwaukee? I mean, you sound like you still have some feelings about the good old Midwest. Why'd you leave?
Comedy, through a bizarre licensing law, comedy was illegal in Milwaukee.
What?
Yeah, I know. Well, when they wrote the entertainment codes for the districts of the city and the licenses back in the 50s, comics were MCs or strippers. So they wrote them under, I kid you not, they wrote them under the same license. To this day,
oh my God,
you have to buy an exotic dancing license.
Your
if you
government
charge
work.
Money. Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean,
yeah.
I'm always very efficiency oriented. So if I were a comic trying to get a license, and it was going to cost me, what would it cost me back then?
Back then it was $1,500.
Jesus.
I know.
Well, you know what? Then no question what I do. During my comedy act, I'd be taking my clothes off so I'd get two for the price of one.
Oh, see, then they're laughing for the wrong reason, Marty.
You're absolutely right. Okay, so you came. So why'd you come? Why San Francisco?
There were three cities where you could earn a living at the time. Well, not even a living, but you could make some money. And there were Chicago, Boston, and San Francisco, not New York or L.A., because in New York or L.A., everybody was willing to do it for free for exposure.
Sounds familiar.
And in the Midwest, we're taught you can die from exposure. So I came to San Francisco. Chicago already had an attitude about me because I was from Milwaukee, and that would have persisted. And Boston had bad winters. And this was following the winter of 74. So, and you needed a car in Chicago, but you could take public transportation in Boston.
Oh, you were progressive from day one. You were a mass transit guy.
Well, no, I was just figuring my car wasn't going to last once I got here. And I was right.
Good. Okay, so you got it. Okay, let's go from there to how, other than on the fly, there was no curriculum. Did you learn by taking courses? Did you, Robin Williams was the centerpiece of San Francisco comedy. How did you really get to be a pro?
You know, I think a lot of it has to do with osmosis, where you just immerse yourself in the world. And I get a little bit of Asperger's where I'm not really comfortable around other people, except when I submerge myself, you know, in that scene, and then I can see the scene, especially when there's a, you know, a goal, a destination, being on stage and watching the other comics and learning from them and just learning how to behave and, you know, the whole protocol of working in the nightclub industry and the different audiences. San Francisco audiences are special, and comics know this. And there's something, even Jerry Seinfeld noticed it. He said that San Francisco comics are like denizens of Shangri-La, you know, the Lost Horizon movie. That they're fine as long as they stay up there, and then they leave their little sheltered cove of San Francisco, and they come and they wither and die, and that's true, because we got spoiled by the wonderful audiences in the Bay Area. Hacks would come into San Francisco from off the road and be doing this homophobic and misogynist, you know, BS on stage, and the audience wasn't buying it. You know, I mean, it wasn't booing or anything. They just weren't laughing, and they would come off stage. They don't get it. No, dude, they get it. They get it. They don't like it. And so we were forged in a different crucible, I think, up here. Now comics are leaving earlier. It used to be there was a natural progression in San Francisco. Open mic, and then you become established, and you become an MC, and then you become, you know, you get your chops down, and then you become a middle act, and then the headliners won't follow, so then you become a headliner, and then you move to L.A. Well, about 1990, when the whole scene shifted, because in 84, there were 40 full-time comedy clubs in America.
Wow.
And in 94, there were 440 comedy clubs. So that you had this huge horizontal growth with the same pool of talent. So all you needed to become a headliner in 1988, 1989, was 45 minutes of material and a car to get there, because there were all these one-nighters and in the Central Valley, and there were 14 full-time clubs within a 75-mile radius of San Francisco. And that doesn't include the three in Sacramento. So, yeah, there were just... It was burgeoning. And 1 year, I worked 50 weeks. And the only reason I didn't do the other 2 weeks was because the clubs died. I did 444 paid gigs in 1 year. Yeah. So, I mean, there was... And then... You know, it's the Malcolm Gladwell thing. You know, 10,000 repetitions, and we've, you know, you do something long enough, you either get good at it, or people tell you to stop, or both.
Well, in terms of stopping, for a moment, I want to stop to let our listeners know you're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My special guest, Will Durst, the really probably the Bay Area's kind of iconic comedian, certainly political comedian. There's so many things that were embedded in what he just talked about, and I'm going to ask him about all of them. Number one, he talked about nightclub culture. Number two, he talked about being Aspergerian and that many comedians are really offstage very different, you know, and whether we're implying about that if there were 440 clubs in the 1990s, there's a lot fewer now. What's changed? Why? So we got a lot to talk about. So let's start with really, frankly, what fascinates me most is the stereotype is that most comedians offstage are F up. They're either depressed or they got Asperger's, they got this, and it's only when the structure of the comedy on stage that it all works. What's the truth about yourself off stage and the comics you know? To what extent is the stereotype valid?
Well, the stereotype is based on, you know, sampling of public note, and people see, you know, the famous people. But that drive that it takes to get there, that also separates people. So it's the same ratio as you would suspect happens in, you know, any other profession, except that you have this attraction of what show business is. I mean, it's getting on stage, it's look at me, or it's being an artist where you have something that you have to get out. You are compelled to get it out.
Right.
So that's part of the attraction. And so the cross-section of the people involved you know, of course, is going to be skewed, but it's the same, you know, it's the same. You just have to be educated, a little more educated. You have to have an incredible resistance to rejection. Mm-hmm. You have to have a cast iron gut because people will keep kicking you in it. So all these things that you have to get through is what makes the comics. There are some comics who have funny guy-itis. And funny guy-itis is they can't stop being funny.
Right, right, right.
Some of them are much funnier offstage than they are onstage. They can't control it. And that's how they got into it. You know, I mean, they're just hysterical. Others are technicians. Jerry Seinfeld is a craftsman. He right. crafts a joke. I'm a writer who has learned how to perform. Johnny Steele, I don't know if you know
sure,
him.
Of course.
Johnny is just a pure natural. Johnny just loves people and he loves his mm-hmm. life and so he has the exact opposite problem that I do, in that I'm so structured that for me my act I have to memorize it and learn it A through Z. Mm. You know, I don't have to perform it chronologically. I can go A to L to D to B, you know, but I need the grounding nature of knowing the script, whereas Johnny, he loves the free form. Mm-hmm. And my wife is the same way. My wife is an improviser, and she's one of the most brilliant improvisers that I've ever seen. And I'm not just saying this because she's my... Robin Williams called her the funniest woman
wow.
he ever worked with,
because wow.
they worked together before he got famous.
Wow.
So she knew... She knew Robin when he was the funniest guy in the room, not the funniest guy on the planet. And so they always talked. But it's a cross-section, but it's just that the sampling is, the demographic sampling is different because of the, you got to be a little smarter because you have to be verbal. And so that's, that just skews your sampling.
Well, you talked about having Asperger's. I'm interested in telling whatever you feel comfortable sharing about what Will Durst, the human being, is like, say, in real life, and also maybe in the 5 or 10 minutes before a show. What is he like?
I don't like people. I have a problem with people. It's hard for me to get to know them. You know, I think it's the famous George Carlin line. You know, I like people one and one, but it's when they get in groups of two or more is when I have problems with them. You know, and I'm the same way. I enjoy making, that's hard for me. But before a show, I have to isolate myself, and I used to love working in bars. And they would all have a pinball machine, and that would be my mantra. I would go in there because I could focus on the pinball machine and not worry about the show at all. I could hear the sounds of the laughter, and I could tell how the show was going, you know, just by, I didn't have to be there or within close proximity. And I love the mantra of focusing on something. And that's why I love the little games you could have on the cell phone, because I could focus on that. Before the show, but I need to, and I can't eat before a show because I need that wiry energy on stage. I don't want that bloaty full feeling. And what else? I mean, you find all this stuff out, and I drink coffee all day long. So,
you talk about nightclub culture. What might surprise me about nightclub culture?
It's the same as any other culture when you're working with people of. That you float in and out of their orbits, in that it's kind of surface a lot, but it's almost like an army, you know, the fraternity of people who work in the nightclub business. So the bartender is your friend, the waitress is your friend, and the customers, they're not adversaries, but they're the ones that come in and the whole event surrounds them. But, I mean, your compatriot in arms is, and there's no difference between, you know, the comic on stage and the guy working in the, handing out the nachos. And, you know, you're in on this together. And especially comedians. Comedians have this fraternity thing where, you know, we can talk crap about each other, you know, but somebody else from the outside the comedy world, you know, says something. Hey, man, you don't understand. I mean, anybody who has the cojones to get up on stage to make people laugh out loud on purpose, you don't belong. You don't get to say anything. You know, it's like family. It's almost like family.
For good and for bad. So what are kind of things that comics might say to each other that are not so so sweet and nice and family Thanksgiving-y?
Oh, well, there's always a little taunting. Sometimes there's a reckless use of either stimulants or depressants, which can get in the way of focus and relationships and career. So we lost a lot of great comics to drugs. Mostly it's ribbing. Mostly it's ribbing. You know, like, we know so much about the stage experience that we could detect a tiny little tear in the fabric of the show that the audience doesn't recognize, maybe the other you know, waitresses and bartenders don't have time to, but we could see the one guy in, you know, dead stage left who's not paying attention and is trying to, you know, one up the guy on stage by telling his little tale, and then you could say that guy was a problem, you know. I mean, you really got him involved in the show. You know, so it's just the angles and the perspective.
Did any ever in your entire life, did any fellow comic actually get you with something that really took to heart, and you really felt either terrible about it or it made you change?
Oh, I'm sure it's happened, but I've totally sublimated it. There are occupational weird hazards. One time, I used to do this bit, and I have no idea. No, I can't remember why I did the bit, but I would take the microphone with the cord and I would throw it up in the air so that it was free-falling, now going behind my back until the microphone came between my legs,
because
it went all the way back, and I would catch it between my legs so it looked like kind of a phallic thing, because I would grab it there. And one time I had somehow misjudged the length of cord that I was supposed to hold on to, and, you know, that little connection between the microphone and the cord, it snapped, and so this penis-looking thing shoots out from between my legs, and it hits a woman in the forehead, and the screen, so she had this subdermal hematoma of the screen on her forehead. And it was,
I'll tell you,
it was hysterical.
That gives a whole, you know, you normally think about microphones amplifying. Well, that amplified you in a way that maybe, you know. You've heard of thrust microphones? Well, there's a thrust microphone, so to speak. Yes. Well, let's go on stage for a minute. So, did you ever have a signature bit? You know, I think about the George Carlin Heavy 7 is like the ultimate in my memory. Do you have a signature bit and you want to do it for us? A brief one?
No, I always, every comic in his act, I never had a call phrase or a catchphrase. I never had any of those. My problem was I'm always trying to stay so current, and part of that is because I feel like if it's happening and I'm not talking about it as the topical comic, I'm being bogus. But the hard part right now with Trump is not writing the new material. It's figuring out where it goes in the act.
Really?
I have these orphan lines, and they're wonderful lines, and I don't know where I can put them. One is Trump said that he always wanted a Purple Heart. You know what that means? That means he always wanted to be wounded or killed, and he's not the only one.
Right.
It's not Trump's hair that bothers me so much as the brain underneath that thinks the hair is cool. And Trump gets in trouble every time he talks. So my theory is his best chance to win this election is to slip into a coma for the next 2 months.
Now you make a point of saying that you are, you know, an equal opportunity offender. So what do you have? What do you have on Hillary Clinton?
You know, my problem with Hillary is that I respect her a lot, and I think she should be president. And I don't understand why they have just, I mean, they They've been battling her since 1992. The Republicans have hated her. The conservatives hate her so much, and I don't understand why. I don't know why they went after her like this. I don't know if it was that cookies line, you know, I'm not going to stay home and bake cookies, or the Clintons, remember in 92, they were advertising themselves as two for one, and I don't know if that, but she has had to grow this hard candy shell. So that's my opening line is, ladies and gentlemen, the woman who broke the glass barrier, beware of falling shards. The former First Lady of the United States, former U.S. Senator for the state of New York, former Secretary of State, former female, former human, Hillary Diane Rodham Clinton.
What might surprise me about being a comic? Anything might, the actual, what might surprise me?
I think the fact that you are nervous every time. Every time in front of every crowd. I performed at the Punchline since, I think my first time on stage there was in 79, in November of 79. It was one of the first places I played when I moved to San Francisco. And so I've been playing there for 37 years. And I still do a week there every year. I think I'm doing the day before the election. I think I'm doing November 7th there. But I still get nervous every single... Same club. That's me. Some people don't get nervous. Some people drink to get rid of the nerves. Some people are just naturals and they go up there.
Are you nervous and you're afraid you're going to screw up? Are you afraid that... Is it just free-floating? What's the anxiety?
For me, it's the angle, the wedge, to crack open that crowd, because every crowd is like a different nut. And when you get that first laugh, and then it's and the quality of the laugh, and you're judging all these things. I mean, you're judging the audience before you go up there, and it's not judging so much as statistically marking down certain characteristics.
What's that mean? For instance,
they're talking amongst themselves. It's a happy little murmur, and I love the murmur. I love the murmur before the show starts. Or when another comic is on, sometimes you're the last act in a three-act show, so you can not judge, but you can ascertain certain proclivities by what they're either laughing at or not laughing at, or whether they're paying attention, or whether the comic is kind of skewing the audience by talking about large genitals, which doesn't help you with your political fare. So, I mean, you're marking all this stuff down, and you get a little spreadsheet in your brain about, oh, they're heavy on the genital jokes. They love those. So maybe this stuff is you're going to have to, you know, shoot past it. And so you're – but you're still nervous until you get that first laugh.
Yeah.
And being in – excuse me. Being in the moment helps. Being in the here and now. You know, we're here at the Punchline Financial District on a winter night, you know, and do jokes about that.
Interesting. And – do you want to do a little bit, either from your Elect to Laugh that you're going to be doing, I understand, 50 times in the next 65 days? You got a little bit you want to do for us on that?
Well, I talk about Donald Trump, and, you know, everybody tells me that I must be in comedy heaven because, you know, Trump must be this huge gift. Well, yeah, but no, because how do you parody a parody? Donald Trump is the GOP nominee for president. That's the joke.
Yeah, sure.
It's like trying to staple smoke or, yeah.
It really does speak to the bad electoral system we have. The way it requires 4 years of flesh pressing and millions of dollars of donations, it really does preclude the really our best people from becoming running for office. You also do this other show called Boomer Raging.
Well, that's what I did because I did an Elect to Laugh in 2012. We thought, you know, that four-year quadrennial cycle would never be repeated in terms of possible material until this year. But I did it, same thing, Super Tuesday until the election, same thing at the Marsh every Tuesday. And then my act evaporated, and nobody wanted to hear anything about politics ever. Although Obama was tougher, you know, and Hillary or Donald would be a little easier, but you know, Obama, I mean, there was no scandal ever. Anyhow, so what I did was I knew I had to write a legacy piece, an evergreen piece that wouldn't be topical, that I could do and get better at and not have to worry about changing it.
Good point.
Yeah, and so I wrote the thing about being a baby boomer because I figure I'll always be a baby boomer. But my secret agenda is if I get the right audience, I can do the same show over and over and it will always seem fresh to them.
Get polished for you.
Yeah, yeah.
So do you have a little, you want to do us a little, give us a little taste of that?
Oh, the Boomer Show?
Yeah.
Oh, the Boomer Show is... It's jokes about being, I have a list of, you know, not everything is bad about being a baby boomer. There are some, and I use an overhead projector in the show because it harkens back to a simpler time.
Right.
Yeah, and so the top, I think I have the top list of bright sides of being an extreme adult.
Tell me one. I want to hear about this. I'm entering that phase.
Peeing three times a night turns out to be a highly effective means of home security. We're still doing drugs, only now there's a copay. Yeah. And there's like 12, and I can't remember them all.
You ever think of stopping being a comedian?
Oh, you know, you spend so much time at one thing to get good at it, and you kind of want to go on. I know other people who want to retire. I can't imagine it.
I have this picture of them, you know, Cardi, you know, the pallbearer is calling you, and the casket opens up and you got one more line
left. Right. I love that. With a microphone in my hand.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, that's perfect icon. Now, you had said, gave me permission to do this on the air. You told me that you're going to be really busy. You're going to be doing 50 performances, including every Tuesday night at the Marsh, between now and Election Day.
November 8th.
But because you're a political comedian, after Election Day, it's not exactly the hot times for a comic.
No.
And so I told you, you know, what I do in my day job is I'm a career counselor. And I asked your permission whether I could play career counselor for a few minutes so that, dear listeners, maybe there's some takeaway for you, or simply I can be of help to a good man. Well, there is a good man, and it is my pleasure to do it. So give me a couple of clues.
Well, I want to do another one-man show.
Okay.
Because I like the whole idea of one-man show. I don't have to follow the giant genital jokes, you know, which is, you know, great in their own, but it takes the audience away from me. So I like setting the whole mood. I like doing 90 minutes. You know, 70 to 90 minutes is what these shows are. I'm thinking of doing a show about the presidents of the United States, because then I figure I could take it into schools and get grants, and, you know, I could get subsidized maybe. I'm thinking of doing a show about the Bay Area, San Francisco, the uniqueness. I want to call that one Ring Toss for Aliens, because that's what the pyramid building and Sutro look like. Yeah, so those are a couple possibilities. Someone came up to me and said, do one on gender. Someone told me to do one on the environment.
I'm going to take them one step at a time, one at a time. Let's go. Give me the first one. I'm going to give you
first
my honest
critique. First one was U.S. presidents.
Love it, because in the end, you know, you've told me that, you know, stand-up comedy is having a tough time. And it's going to be really hard to rely on people coming in. Young people, when they're single, is when they come in to go, they want to go out and they want to, you know.
18 to 35 is
right,
the average age.
And you're just
audience.
A bit over that. And and so it may be wise to not try to rely on ticket sales for your income, whereas grant money is good. And as really one of the, if not the brand name comedian in America for politics, going into schools to make the right, have some really professional grant proposal writer. If you're a writer yourself, maybe you do it. But make the case for how we're trying to create better civic responsibility, better citizens. And what better way than to put a human and ethical face on the presidents? That rings true to me, and it's an evergreen. It's not something that you can do forever. What's your honest reaction to that one?
Well, my problem, that's exactly what I'm focusing on, but my problem is that I'm so kind of not what schools would want. I'm kind of subversive.
Bay Area is all subversive.
I know,
including the public schools. Believe me.
Yeah. So there would be an educational,
absolutely,
but it would be the reverse. It would not be an honoring or
That's what I would love to do. Perfect. So you have my absolute two thumbs up on that. But I'm going to be much tougher on the next ones. Tell me the next one.
The Bay Area.
It's. I don't think it's
that
funny. The People's
Republic of San Francisco.
Yeah, I think just like with the gender one, you're going to run a risk. People are so damn sensitive here that I think you're going to either annoy people too much, or there isn't going to be that much. It's like when you tried to criticize Hillary, you couldn't really do it because you're just a true believer. It's going to be the same about the Bay Area. I think that's good. That and the gender thing. You know, one thing that a white male cannot do is talk about gender or race. You buy that, by the way.
Yes,
in the Bay Area. Those are bad ideas.
Water and the environment? Water is going to be the new...
Oh, come on. You're not giving a lecture. You're being a comedy. No, you got it right. Remember, your brand is politics. Presidents are core to the curriculum, showing a human and more subversive... Look, here in the Bay Area, the people's history of the United States is more popular than the mainstream stuff.
Right, right.
So, you're exactly right in your politics.
Should I talk to Howard Zinn and see if I can
isn't he still in the grave? I think you'd have to pull a... maybe if you give him a microphone that he shoves over his head in the back and comes out as a thrust penis, it might work out. But anyway... when you said to me both off the air and the on the air that you're really first a writer and then a comedian, I want you to put your writer, as you create this, I want you to realize this is your magnum opus. It's a way to leave a legacy. Not your boomer thing is a legacy of a different sort, but this is better because it's transmitting to the next generation. I want you to put your best damn writer's hat on and write the most amazing F script that you could. I can't use the word, right? About the not all the presidents. Pick only the gold. Really the gold that's funny as hell, but is also revealing of their human side. Also would enhance civic responsibility. Create a sample of like one or two of the presidents. Use that as your proof of concept, which you send into the proposal. Get a grant proposal writer. Send it to the NEA. Send it to the foundations. There's a million liberal foundations here that would kill. The San Francisco Ed Fund is a major one that funds educational stuff like this. Major school districts have a foundation. San Francisco public schools may have a foundation. Or rich, more suburban schools that are also quite liberal also have foundations where fat cat resident people who live there donate money to the foundations to provide... supplement. I think you can make big money and make a big difference. What do you really think, Will Durst?
Wow.
I can't do better than that.
No, you can't.
Will Durst, thanks for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco. Okay, so Tuesday nights from now at Marsh in San Francisco.
Marsh.
What else?
Well, everywhere. You know, one of the things I want to do is take some time off and write a mystery novel set at a comedy club. Murder at the Holy City.
Later. That's when you're old. Not yet. Now I want you to be doing the greatest job on Elect to Laugh, and then I want you to write the script and the proposal.
Thank you, buddy.
Okay, it is a pleasure. Will Durst, the
preeminent. Changed my life.
Well, maybe I will. Email me. Let me know how it goes.
Send
me a draft. I'll rip it apart.
I will.
It's my way. Okay.
Thank you, Marty Nemco.
Okay. Take care, Will.
You too, man.
Right. I know you got to duck out. You can see he's a loving husband. He's got a wife. He's got to do something.
Yeah, we got to go to some concert thing.
Exactly. Okay, dear listeners, I know you hate me because I didn't let you call in to ask him questions, but I had to be monogamous with him. So, okay. Yeah, absolutely, Will. You got an open invitation. All right. But now, my dear listeners, you have an open invitation. I want to focus on you. This was funny, helpful. I love doing that semi-regular feature on the show called What's It Really Like to Be A? We've done everything from psychiatrist to prostitute, but we've never done comedian, and so it was a pleasure to have the, you know, just great guy and a really good comedian, Will Durst. But now, you are center stage. If you or someone you care about has got a work-related problem, whether you're 16 or 76, whether you're unemployed or a CEO, whether it's for-profit, non-profit, whatever, I really, after this year, I think it's 27 years. I finish doing this show in October and enter my 28th year. Hope to do it for as long as I can. I really hope to do it for a really long time. I love it. But my mission is here to help you. So if you're struggling, I usually can solve your problem because I've heard it all in these 27 years. So the harder, the better. I don't care if you're curled up in a bed with you know, snorting coke or whatever it is, uppers or downers, and you can't get out of bed, but you need to make money, or you are a high-powered CEO of a nonprofit or a for-profit, but you're still unhappy and miserable. You got a spouse who's spending too much money, whatever. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco and KALW, which is, of course, the station you're listening to, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And while we're waiting for the calls to come in, you know, maybe it's just me, but America seems to be coming, and this is a fancy term, bimodal. That's like two big humps in the curve. There's a big chunk of people who hang out a lot. And then there's this other chunk where it's like we're dervishes whirling ever faster. And when you ask those dervishes how they are, their answer is more likely to be swamped than fine. You hear the hurry in their voice. You see the furrows between their brows. And when you ask them to get together, a typical response is, I'm slammed. How about mid-October? Not only are the dervishes busier, they're busier with more stressful things. Not just changing a bunch of passwords or waiting for the cable guy. Ever more is demanded of people at work. Used to be people who had soft skills, you know, they were organized and they were people. They're good on a team. Now they're expected to get technical. That's stress. Layoffs, reduced hours, or swords overhead. Stress. At home, men and women are expected, after a long day of work, be fully present for each other, willing to process our partners' and kids' issues at the same time as we're making dinner. Stress. And when they finally want to relax, turn on the TV news to relax, whether it's CNN or Fox, either side of the spectrum, they're likely to hear rancorous partisans for Clinton and Trump yelling over each other to call each other racist, sexist, or otherwise unfit. And what if you have an illness? That's stress plus. Try now to negotiate the healthcare system. It's enough to make you, well, sick. Today's life can feel like a maelstrom with us in the vortex. And yet there are escape hatches to islands of sanity. Here are some examples. You can work from home. Whether you get to telecommute one day a week, 2 days a week, or you're self-employed, it feels so nice to feel some control over your life. You don't need to race out of the house so you can sit in some traffic that's going to be unpredictable between terrible and stopped. It's out of control. You're out of control. No need to stop working when a coworker wants to chat. You're out of control. No need to worry your boss is going to think you're slacking if you take a break to do yoga or have lunch with a friend or, heaven forbid, even watch a soap opera. Then, when you're working from home, you're in control. That's an island of sanity. And believe it or not, there actually are relaxing jobs. Here's some examples. I think about craftspeople I know, like a furniture restorer. There's a guy on College Avenue, and he patiently is restoring furniture and making a living. House painters. There isn't usually a lot of stress, not time pressure. Jewelry makers. Another relaxing job, a true scholar. I'm not talking about the professors who endlessly race to get as many grants and journal articles as they can, but the real scholars who take the time to become a real expert in something important, like maybe it takes usually a few years to write a definitive biography of somebody. That's a real scholar, but it's relaxing. It's not time pressure. You're immersing yourself in the life of somebody. Another relaxing job, dating coach. Many people crave love. They even cling to the dream of the lifetime marriage made in heaven. Alas, some people like that are lousy at attracting and keeping Mr. Right and Ms. Right. Dating coaches help. Relaxing. Fun. How about work at weddings like I did? I was a piano. I've played over 2,000 weddings and bar mitzvahs. Be a musician at a wedding. That's where you can make the money, not playing at open mic nights. Or be a celebrant. A lot of people in the Bay Area are not religious. They don't want a priest or a rabbi, a minister or an imam. You don't have to be a celebrant, officiating over a wedding. Or be a photographer at a wedding, but be creative. Another low-stress job, dog walker. I often take my dog Einstein on a trail with lots of doggies and dog walkers. And every time I stop them, they tell me they really love their job. Now, you're not going to get rich, I got it. But there are a lot of people who would gladly trade money for a career of walking in nature with doggies. Or a massage therapist. Think about it. Fragrance, touch, serene music, healing. What could be bad? Yeah, standing on your feet all day, but that's a price that may be worth paying. Or work in a park. There are rangers, the environmental educators, trail maintainers, you know, the ones who clear off the trails and put berms of wood and all that stuff. Whatever. Or work in a flower shop. Flower places are happy places. They're, you get to be surrounded by natures and hybridizers. I was a rose hybridizer, so I've got to give them credit too. Nature's and hybridizers' most beautiful creations. Flowers really are the most beautiful creation, period, on Earth. You live around them. People come to you for pleasure. You give it to them time after time. And if you're at all artistic, you can have more low-stress pleasures by being a flower ranger, like Ikebana, which I think is just gorgeous. All right. I'll do more of this stuff about Islands of Sanity, but I don't want to keep my dear callers waiting on hold too long, so I'll give out the phone number just one more time quickly in case I may have time for you, I may not. 415 if you want to work over, 415-841-4134. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hello.
Hello.
Oh, clearly the comedy bug has bitten you.
For today, you know, it's amazing. You get on a roll. I can be wildly serious and amazing, quasi-depressed, but you get Will Durst on the air, and it evokes the comedy guy in me. It really is not a fake or anything. It's just you start in that mode, and then you stay in that mode. And so, yes, today I'm that way. Isn't that weird?
No. It's great. I just wanted to let your listeners know that you're going to be at the public library.
Oh, look at you.
On the 18th.
I didn't plant them. I swear on my life. Yes, it's true. The 17th. You're wrong. The 17th. September 17th, 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. It's free.
No, it's October. September 18th.
17th.
17th?
That's a Saturday afternoon, isn't it?
Oh, okay.
Yep.
My question is, I know someone not well, and they really seem unhappy about their work and their situation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, how to broach that, you know. This is a neighbor, and they're really they're normally an upbeat person, mm-hmm. I think.
Mm-hmm.
And they're clearly unhappy about their work situation,
okay.
You know.
So, what feels right and wrong about this, just to see if we can cut to the chase beautifully and easily here. What if you simply invited him for a drink or a cup of coffee at your place or whatever and say, I know this may seem a little out of place, but it comes from a good place, comes from a good heart. You know, I've seen you normally be quite an upbeat guy or woman, whatever it is, but I've noticed that you seem, you know, every time I ask you about work or whatever, you seem really down about it. And, you know, I'd love to talk with you about it if you feel it might be of help. Is there a reason you haven't done that or would or shouldn't do that?
Well, I've already done that, and this person doesn't realize that I have, you know, because of a disability, I work only part-time. So she's like, well, you're kind of like, banana, one foot on a banana and one foot on a cake of soap. You know, how are you going to help me? So, it's a work in progress.
Well, if she's, you know, how sure, you know, when even if somebody was a stay-at-home person with a profound handicap,
mm-hmm.
you certainly don't sound unintelligent. You sound intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering whether her reason for not saying yes has nothing to do with you, but she either doesn't want to deal with it yet or whatever. So what you might even want to do is send her a handwritten note and say, you know, I know you turned me down, but I've actually got a fair amount of expertise in this area. And just as a human being, and I don't know if you're attracted to her or not, whatever you want to say the truth. I'm here if, and you know, you've got an open invitation. I might even print up a little ticket good for one coffee and stick it in there, no expiration date. So you make it a little humorous, and maybe that at least keeps the door open for the moment when she's ready to do it.
Okay. Keep the day job, but think about doing some stand-up.
Thank you. Well, come September 17th. Like I said, it is free at the Coret Auditorium, which is the lovely auditorium in the basement of the main branch of the public main library at San Francisco in the Civic Center. It's my show, Odd Man Out, and I am grateful. My wife is there to annoy me. She gets up in the middle of the show. She annoys me all the time. I'm trying to tell my stories, and she is annoying me. And I was able, because I play the piano a lot, accompanying singers, I had a ridiculously inflated sense of who I could get. I went and tried for the number one best singer in the Bay Area. She won the Bay Area Theater Critics Award for Best Performer and was nominated 5 additional times. Her name is Daniela Beam. She is going to sing 5 songs, showstoppers, and it's all free. No 2-drink minimum.
And that's 3 to 5, right?
3 to 5 on Saturday, the 17th. Get your dates right, dude.
Will do.
All right. Take care. Will do, Will Durst. Anyway, that was my guest, by the way. I love Will Durst. Do come see him every Tuesday night at the Marsh Theater in San Francisco. He will be doing his act, Elect to Laugh, which, of course, is going to be about Donald Trump with a little bit about Hillary. So, anyway, let's go back to the phones. No, I think what I want to do is I want to finish my little talk about Islands of Sanity. Other ways to have, and this is, you know, it's not really related to work, so maybe I shouldn't do it. All right, no, I should let it go. All right, let's go back to the phones. My priority is you. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hi, this is Claudia. I'm in the East Bay.
Hey, Claudia.
Hi. And I've had I was a newspaper reporter for 17 years, and now I've got an encore career that I created. It has to do with teaching, well, with three different aspects of memoir writing. I've been teaching memoir writing through adult education venues, and then I also have private clients, either people writing a memoir who need a little help putting it together, or people who have great stories but they're not writers. In
right.
which case, I guess you could call me a ghostwriter.
Yeah.
And I'm having a lot of fun with it. And the only problem is that I'm moving to a little city just outside of Portland, Oregon, where I really don't have connections. And it looks like I went online to see about different venues for teaching, and it seems like everybody in Portland is teaching English. So it doesn't look like I'm going to have any help through the institutions. I'm going to have to create something to get myself known, and I thought I'd ask you for advice.
I'm wondering, and I may be wrong, I happen to know somebody who used to be a reporter for the Oakland Tribune, and and she has been doing memoir writing workshops and the like. You should team up with her, even because so much of this stuff could be done virtually by Skype and email and phone and whatever. Her name is Francine, and I'm sure she would not mind my giving her name. Her name is Francine Brevetti, B-R-E. She's a lovely woman. B-R-E-V-E-T-T-I. Just have a nice little chat with her, you know, and maybe you can you can join forces in one way or another. my favorite idea on the ghostwriting piece is people who are famous, sub-famous, when they've just peaked, you know, so, you know, it was Andy Warhol said, we have 15 minutes of fame. But people who have tasted that heroin called fame find it really hard to withdraw. And they're particularly vulnerable to a pitch from a ghostwriter that says, you know, I love your story. You were amazing. Da 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 da. How would you like for us to work together on your biography? And if we can either give me a fee. My fee is $40,000 or $50,000 or whatever. Or we can agree. You give me a little less, and we'll try to, you know, if we sell it to a publisher, you know, that can be an advance against royalties, whatever. So who is one person who is a mild has been, but who really had a fair amount of fame, whom you really respect and like and would love to get immersed in his or her life?
It's hard to think of. You know, if I were just writing my own stuff, these would be people who have no money, but
No, a famous person.
I can't think of the name of anybody I've had, but guys who've been wrongfully imprisoned. I would love to interview them and help write their stories. But they wouldn't have any money to pay me in advance, and I'd have no guarantee of publication, you know, so I'd be a couple of years with no income while we got something written.
Right, right. And it probably wouldn't sell. The odds are too great these days. There's just too many books coming out. It's too hard to sell. It needs to be a brand name. If it's going to sell at all, it's going to have to be a brand name of somebody who, let's say he was or she was even guilty, but getting their human story. Who was a famous, you know, like Milken, like Michael Milken. The reason I mention him is because when he came out, he's donated millions to these good charities and causes and whatever, you know, and he's kind of now a little, you know, out of the public light. But somebody who may be guilty, but who's a brand name, who's intriguing, whom you nonetheless relate to and, you know, would at least pitch and say, and they for them, $50,000, they wipe their noses with
$50,000. I see.
Does that make sense?
I don't know. I can't think of anybody offhand. I mean, my personal interests are, you know, not towards the famous necessarily, but even the temporarily famous. But I that's an interesting thought. I would maybe consider something like that.
And you know, people who have the sensibility, you're talking about wrongfully imprisoned people and listen to KLW, I'm guessing what you're the only chance to make a living doing writing is through that grant process, because you know, you're not going to work for corporate America, I gather, from what am I right?
No, I'm not so much.
Right, I got it.
I have some personal memoirs going as far as grants go. Maybe I should share that too, but my dad was a civil rights activist back before there was a civil rights movement.
But no money. Are you worried about money? If you're not worried about money, we have a whole different story.
Well,
but you implied
I don't need a lot of money. I need some. I should be retired, but I can't quite make it on the retirement stuff I've got coming in. So
right.
I
so
need
I'm gonna
a little bit.
Yeah, I'm gonna ask you to defer. You know, it's a cliche to tell you the truth. Millions of people who have their family member or themselves, this lovely story, but you end up spending. It's a huge time suck to write it. If you need money, put that, make that the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow after you've made some. That's a bad metaphor. It's the reward at the end. Make the money you need now and defer that book until you've done this one. Does that make sense?
Yeah, or in my other time. I don't need to work full time. I mean, right now I've been working about half time, and that's fine. That's been enough to take care of what I need. You know, beyond the Social Security and some other little bits of income that I've got.
The other thing I would do is, and I'm just in the interest of time, I would suggest that you contact the school districts in Portland, and they often have grant money, and they, whether it be a website or a blog or a student newspaper online or whatever, that you, because of your journalist background, you'd be willing to come in and after school commandeer the student newspaper, thereby training the next generation to be in your image. Of the kind of journalist you want, and that may get you some money and be consistent with your values.
That's a thought too. I mean, journalism is such a dead end career now.
No, you're not training to be journalists. Writing and teaches thinking.
Sure.
Writing teaches rhetoric. Writing teaches argumentation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Newspaper writing teaches civic responsibility. So, there is no career in journalism anymore. Even the Huffington Post, big liberal that talks about raising wages, pays everybody zero. All of their columnists, Time, I've written 20 essays for Time. They pay me zero.
That's horrible. Yeah.
Yeah. That welcome. And I'm not shy, as you can tell. I'm not afraid to negotiate. Mm-hmm. And they say, screw you. Bye. Sorry, we can get somebody to work for free. So, yes, there's no career. Journalism is not a career anymore. Everybody, it's a free activity. It's like voting. It's a civic responsibility, but it's not a living. Anyway, I got to go.
Okay, thank you. I'll check some of that out.
That's
all right.
That's my best shot. Okay, and that is Work with Marty Nemko. I was told I tend to leave the show a little late, so I need to get out early so there's plenty of time for the promos for the subsequent shows, so I'm going to be a good little boy. That is Work with Marty Nemko for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Debbie Kennedy, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do workovers on callers and terms to use at work that will impress, like opportunity cost or thought experiment. They really are very valuable, not only in impressing, but improving the quality of your thinking. I guess that's going to be a more serious show than today. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.
For the archive of Dr. Marty Nemko's articles, information on his 8 books, including his new book, The Best of Marty Nemko, plus how you can consult privately with Marty, go to martynemko.com. That's MartyNemko.com. And join Marty again next Sunday morning at 11 for Work with Marty Nemko here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco.